You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, temperatures are on the rise, which means we'll have to be on the lookout for ticks and mosquitoes. We'll find out how bad bug season will be and how to avoid the bites. Now, June is a big month for the United States Supreme Court. The nation's highest judicial body is set to release its decisions in a number of cases this month. Court watchers are following four big cases in particular, including another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, a lawsuit challenging voting rights in Arizona, and more. You're part of this conversation about SCOTUS. Call 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about these cases? What are your thoughts on issues that the court is ruling on, like voting rights or the future of the ACA? What do you want to know about the current makeup of the court? You can call 800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about some of the cases, but first, this is the first batch of major decisions from a new court, which now includes Justice Amy Coney Barrett. We know the court is conservative, but there are still open questions as to just where the newer justices will start to fall on that ideological spectrum. What's your take?
Well, so the biggest problem right now is that we don't have a whole lot of data because of the lateness of adding the new justice to the court. And because she had to recuse from a number of cases that she didn't hear, we've only actually had her vote in 28 out of the 40 cases that were decided so far this year. So we don't have a whole lot of information. We're probably going to have to wait not only for this term, but a couple of more to get a real good sense of who she is and how she's going to behave. But I will say this, one of the measures we use as scholars of the court is to look at what are called inter-agreement rates. That is, who do you vote with as a member of the court? Who do you pair up with most frequently? And what we're seeing with her right now is that she is voting 100% in lockstep with both Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch, and 96% of the time with Alito, 93% of the times with Kavanaugh. So your initial inclination that it's a conservative court is true because they added what appears to be another conservative member of the bench in Justice Barrett. And if you wanted to know, she agrees least with Justice Sotomayor about 64% of the time.
Well, one of the big cases we'll get a ruling on is yet another challenge to the Affordable Care Act. This one is brought by the Texas Attorney General and joined by prosecutors from other states, too. What's at issue in this case that the court needs to decide?
So there are a couple of issues, and they're a little odd because of some of the changes that we saw in 2017. When the Republicans controlled the legislature at the national level and Trump was in office. And so, you know, one of the campaign promises from Trump was to try to eradicate the ACA. And one of the things they did was they eliminated the requirement that if you don't get health care and you have no health care, that there's no longer a penalty. They zeroed out the penalty. And so the question that arises from that, if there's no longer really an individual mandate, is it still constitutional to require people to have health care? And if it's not constitutional to let them have health care, does the rest of the legislation just fall because it doesn't make any sense without the mandate? Now, there are a couple of questions that the court has to tangle with. And the first one is what we often call a threshold question, which means, can you actually get in the door to the court? And it's an issue of standing. And standing has to do with whether or not you are actually harmed. And it's actually something that might disrupt a decision on the merits in this case, because there are individuals who brought the case who said they're harmed, even though that they don't have to pay a fee or a tax based upon not having health care. And then Texas says they have this administrative cost in trying to keep the system going. So that's the first issue. The second is whether or not the individual mandate is still constitutional if you don't have to pay a penalty. And I think this is going to be one of the fundamental questions in the decision that comes down. And then the last one is known as severability. So if the mandate is unconstitutional, does the rest of the legislation collapse? My take on it is they'll probably get through the standing issue. They'll probably say the individual mandate is kind of a moot point. But I suspect that the remainder of the legislation is going to stay in place. And the biggest argument actually came from Chief Justice Roberts, who said, well, they amended this in 2017 to eliminate the tax penalty. why didn't they just kill the whole bill if the intent was, if we get rid of the mandate, the whole thing will collapse like a deck of cards? Mm. So my suspicion is the ACA is going to remain, even though there will no longer be a requirement that you have health care.
Well, that's interesting that it came from Chief Justice Roberts, because he was the hinge when it came to whether the individual mandate was a tax back in 2012 when the court took this up.
Right. In that case, National Federation of Independent Businesses versus Sebelius, you know, I remember watching CNN that day because bated breath everybody had about whether or not this was going to be sustained by the court. And then, of course, the hue and cry from conservatives who were claiming that Roberts was all of a sudden some sort of stealth liberal on the court. But true, he sustained the individual mandate using the taxing and spending authority of the United States Supreme or U.S. Congress under the Constitution. And so my suspicion is that he is not going to sort of go off the rails here and decide that the entire ACA all of a sudden disappears because of one little alteration that that Congress made in 2017.
Yeah, because at that time it was, wait, does that mean it's still a law? Wait, does that mean we throw the whole thing out? Wait, what's happening? As people furiously tried to read through and interpret that opinion back then. So we'll certainly be watching what happens with the ACA. Charlie Jacobs is a professor at St. Norbert College. We're talking about cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court right now and in the future. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know? What do you think? Or maybe there's a piece of this that you misunderstand or want some clarification on. Now's the time to call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Voting laws and restrictions are a big issue right now, talking a lot about it in the news. And there is a voting rights case that we should get a ruling on from the court. This one pertains to two new voting laws in Arizona. Charlie, what's happening there?
So this case, Brnovich versus DNC, actually involves some amendments to voting regulations that happened, one of them at least 5 years ago. And so the two different provisions include whether or not it is permissible for the discarding of a ballot that was submitted by a voter, but they voted in the wrong precinct or the wrong polling place. And the second one has to do with criminalizing the idea of ballot harvesting. And ballot harvesting is when someone who is not permitted by law collects a bunch of ballots from individuals who are using absentee forms and then bringing them all in at the same time to the registrar of voters. Now, the first one is an issue because you may have voted at the wrong polling place, and hence you would have gotten your very discreet local candidates wrong, but your vote for president, state senate, those were probably okay, but the entire ballot gets tossed. And so there's an issue about losing the intent of the voter. And the second one has to do primarily with arguments related to whether or not that's going to harm minority groups who traditionally use both absentee ballots and the idea of harvesting to help get their votes to the registrar of voters. And so that falls under an issue and a potential violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and whether or not this is a discriminatory act.
So states like Georgia and Florida have passed new voting restrictions. We've got similar laws being considered in here in Wisconsin, in Texas, other states. Does the ruling in this Arizona case automatically affect those laws?
It likely will, because the court is unlikely to take up challenges to those new regulations. And I think there are about 14 states now, if my count is correct, that have made these kinds of alterations. And I mean, I think part of the signaling to do this is not only what we saw in the last election and some of the claims of fraud and problems, but Justice Roberts opened up the door several years ago in a case out of Texas that kind of eviscerated the Voting Rights Act and gave the opportunity to a lot of states, in particular southern states that had a history of voting discrimination, to start to clamp down on what they believe to be problems with the process. And they always make the claim that there is this rampant fraud that they have to check. The problem is organizations like the Brennan Center, who've been studying this for a year, have demonstrated there is very little fraud. And yes, there is fraud, but it is almost inconsequential in elections. And so the court, if they open up this opportunity for states to regulate in this fashion, is going to throw open the doors wide to increasing regulation of the process, which may tamp down opportunities for certain marginalized communities to cast ballots.
Does this case involve this question of whether it's the states or the federal government who has the power to set these election laws?
Well, a bit. There is some power by for the federal government to regulate under sections of the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. And so they have the opportunity to regulate in order to protect equality of rights of individuals to cast a ballot. But for the most part, the Constitution allows states to set the time, place, and manner of elections. And because of that, the federal courts have generally been very deferential to the states, as long as it doesn't violate the Voting Rights Act, as long as it doesn't create significant hurdles to discrete and insular minorities in casting their ballots. And so, you know, there are opportunities for the federal government to intervene. But as we've seen in the past couple of weeks, there's been real resistance, in particular in the Senate, and there's a potential filibuster of any kinds of challenges to the ability of states to regulate these processes.
Charlie Jacobs is with us on Central Time as we talk about some of the cases that the U.S. Supreme Court is deciding this month, including a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. He's a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. And you can join in with your questions or your thoughts now at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about some of these cases? What do you think about the current makeup of the court? How would you like to see the justices rule on certain cases? You can call now at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. The conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court decisions we expect to hear this month. I'm Keeley Boltina. Charlie Jacobs is our guest. He's a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Supreme Court? Maybe it's about the cases in front of them now or how certain things work at the Supreme Court. You can call in at 800-642-1234. We've got Tom from Green Bay on the phone now. Hey, Tom.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question is around the number of justices on the court and what the actual process is to expand it. I understand the current administration has formed some sort of task force or committee, but what's the reality in terms of Congress's involvement? What are the gates to it actually happening versus the legal posturing?
Thank you. All right, Tom, thank you so much for that question. And Charlie, this is something that came up all last year during the election, too.
Yeah, so the Constitution didn't prescribe how many justices there were to be on the court. And so it's varied over time from six to as many as 10. We have had nine as the standard number for well over a century now. It only requires the statutory change through the normal bicameral process and the signature by the President of the United States. But I don't think I have to tell the listeners about the hurdles that the Biden administration would face if they're going to try to get that kind of legislation through our polarized Congress right now. It's really unlikely to occur. And I think that it's not just about the politics of it and whether or not progressives really want Biden to accomplish this or whether or not Democrats in general hope to have a more liberal court. It goes to the legitimacy of the United States Supreme Court and whether or not an administration or a political party or a movement can just add justices in order to get their favorite outcome, because that suggests that the law is variable. That is not something that has a lasting effect and meaning over time. And so I think that the administration created this panel to defer any real discussion. And my sense is that because there are a number of attorneys and judicial scholars who are on this committee, they're going to come back and tell the administration not to do it. And that's going to be their out. They're going to be able to say, see, these experts said we shouldn't do it. That may placate those on the left. And it avoids the turmoil of trying to get that bill passed.
Interesting. Yeah, President Biden did that in April, creating that bipartisan 36-member commission to spend the next 6 months looking at it. So certainly not something that is likely to change very quickly. Charlie, let's talk about another case out of Philadelphia that deals with whether religious groups can refuse to work with same-sex couples hoping to adopt children. That's in front of the court. What are the implications of this case?
So you know, I think that most people probably view this case as a case of gay rights, because this has to do whether or not a Catholic adoption agency that works with the city of Philadelphia to find placement for foster kids, you know, whether or not they can exclude themselves from participating with either unmarried couples or with gays because it violates the principles and tenets of their faith. So that is a very interesting question, but there is a much broader doctrinal issue that goes on with the court and has to do with the free exercise clause. So actually, there's a case from 1990 that bears on this very, very closely, which actually had to do with what was perceived to be religious discrimination against a native tribe and some members who were denied unemployment benefits because they were fired from their job for smoking peyote. The irony of it was, is they were drug counselors who were smoking peyote, but that's another issue related to that.
Yeah.
At any rate, in a really interesting decision by Justice Scalia, he argued that any neutrally drawn law that applies to all equally doesn't necessarily mean that there's religious discrimination. So in this particular case, Philadelphia said, well, we want every organization that we work with to deal with gays and unmarried couples. And it doesn't matter that you're a Catholic organization. That applies equally to everybody. We're not singling out Catholics or the Catholic organization. So you have to abide by this. So what the court is dealing with here is a really fundamental free exercise issue. When are exceptions to be made because a public policy is going to interfere with the ability of religious institutions to meet the goals of their faith? And so, yes, this certainly impacts gay rights, but it has a much broader relationship to the way in which governments may not be able to regulate religion. And to give you the kind of best example, and Justice Scalia actually used this in his decision, you know, if there were a dry county where alcohol was prohibited, well, in that case, it would be fine to prohibit alcohol at, say, Catholic Mass, because it was neutrally drawn. It applies to everybody. So you can't buy a beer and you can't use altar wine at the same time. If this goes the opposite direction in this case, Philadelphia will have to make an exception for this Catholic organization. And you can probably see the implications. Mm-hmm. This would mean that exceptions would probably have to be created for lots of different religions and lots of religious traditions to accommodate their faith.
Sure, because the court sets precedent. Charlie Jacobs is a professor at St. Norbert College, and we're talking about cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court here on the Ideas Network. And we've got Zeke in Wisconsin Rapids ready to join the conversation. Welcome, Zeke.
Hello, Keely. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I was telling your call screener that I really admire your listening ability and letting the callers finish. I had been listening to your show many times, but kind of grew tired of Rob. So I'm really happy to hear you on today. And I appreciate your politeness to the guests and letting them finish their point before you cut them off. So start with that. And Charlie, thank you for being on. You have an excellent way of explaining things. In a not a pontification manner, you're just a real kind of common sense like. So I appreciate that. But my question is pretty simple. And that would be for people like me, the majority, not a Democrat, but the majority of people have had our fill with these whiny Republicans and all their challenges to the laws, voting laws, and so forth, a la Arizona. How long do you think that the Supreme Court is going to tolerate this in terms of time by keep taking these types of cases? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Zeke, thanks for that question. We appreciate that question for Charlie about dealing with voting laws. How receptive is the court to continuing to take up these different facets of voting rights?
So, you know, one of the issues that the court faces is that in most circumstances, they have discretion to not take a case. So this was a bill that was passed in 1925 that gave them almost complete discretion about what to pick and choose. So if they didn't want to take a case for whatever reason, they can decline it and they don't even have to offer an explanation. But there are some cases in which Congress requires them to take a case on its docket. One of them has to do with particular voting right cases. So in many circumstances, they can't sidestep them. They can't punt. They have to take the case. And if it has to do with a Voting Rights Act case, that will often be the circumstance. So, you know, as long as the individuals have standing, as long as they can get in the door, it is likely that they're going to have to take these cases. And, you know, there's going to be precedent where they're easy cases and they can dispose of them rather quickly. But as more and more states start to offer these kinds of prescriptive approaches to the voting process, the court is going to get entangled in it more and more.
We have very little time left, and yet we have a very big thing to talk about, and that's looking ahead to the next judicial term. The court has a lot ahead of it. Give us a quick preview.
So a couple of cases I think that are probably on people's radar screens. One has to do with Mississippi law that is really the most direct challenge to Roe versus Wade that we've seen in probably 25 years. And it has to do with prohibitions on abortion after 15 weeks. And it flies in the face of a 1992 case that came out of Pennsylvania that established something known as the undue burden test. And so it's going to be interesting to see with Barrett on the court and with some new conservatives who haven't grappled with this issue, what they're going to do. So that's one, and that's going to be on the docket in October. So that's going to be argued very early. And the second one is a gun right case that has to do with concealed carry permits. And again, whether or not this conservative court is going to open up the opportunities for gun owners to basically carry weapons at all times and all places without restrictions from the states. I don't think that that's going to happen, because in almost all of these gun rights cases under the Second Amendment, the court has been unwilling to say that the states have no ability to restrict dangerous weapons. So we'll have to see what that one looks like as well.
Yeah, much ahead. Charlie, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. He joined us on the show today to provide an overview of those upcoming decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, including a look at voting rights cases out of Arizona and a gay rights case out of Pennsylvania. And coming up, the warm weather is bringing people outside, along with ticks and mosquitoes. We are getting some tips on how to avoid bites and to stay safe this summer. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, pollen can make COVID-19 worse, plus climate change has made pollen season longer and full of even more of the stuff that makes us sneeze. Hear from a plant physiologist about it ahead. Now, we're in that sweet spot at the end of spring where the air is warm and the sun is shining, but the mosquitoes aren't really out in full force yet. I've gotten a few welts, but I know the worst is still ahead. Tick season, though, that's already begun. We're learning about tick and mosquito season in Wisconsin and how to protect yourself from these pests. Rebecca Osborne is our guest. She's a vector-borne disease epidemiologist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Rebecca, thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network.
Hello, thanks for having me.
When does mosquito season really get into gear?
So it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking the kind of mosquitoes that just cause annoying bites and are a nuisance, but there's also a kind of mosquito that can spread disease. And not all mosquitoes can spread diseases in Wisconsin. Right now, we have a lot of mosquitoes that are first coming out. They may cause some annoying bites and welts and, you know, itchy bumps. There's typically not a lot of disease spread this time of year. We get sort of peak season for the risk of mosquito borne disease in August and September in Wisconsin. But either way, it's certainly possible to get or to be exposed to a virus spread by mosquitoes anytime that they're out and biting. So that includes right now.
What kind of diseases do mosquitoes carry in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the one that people may have heard of already is West Nile virus. That one is, on average, the most common disease spread by mosquitoes in Wisconsin. And it's really a relatively common disease now across the United States. So you do need to think about it even when you're traveling. We do have some others, though, that are spread by mosquitoes that people may or may not have heard of, one of which is called Eastern Equine Encephalitis, which is extremely rare in Wisconsin, but can, unfortunately, in some cases, cause a really severe sort of neuroinvasive disease and cause swelling of the brain. And often people end up in the hospital, and sometimes in rare instances it can even cause death. This one, again, is extremely rare, but can be spread by mosquitoes. There's a few others called Lacrosse virus, Jamestown Canyon virus, and St. Louis encephalitis virus. So all of these are really rare, but they can be spread by mosquitoes, and you don't know just by looking at them which ones are carrying a virus and which ones are not. So it's good to try and protect yourself from bites.
Well, when we think about ticks, too, the big thing that comes to mind is disease, especially Lyme disease. What should we worry about when it comes to tick bites?
Yeah, this is sort of peak tick bite season for the small or juvenile ticks that can spread Lyme disease. So these are the deer ticks that we're talking about. And right now is right when those juvenile ticks, which are really small, about the size of a poppy seed, are, you know, at their most active, and they will continue to be really active sort of through the month of June. These ticks can spread Lyme disease and some other diseases as well. So it's really important, you know, when you're outdoors, even around your own property, but especially out in the woods and sort of grassy and brushy areas, to try and prevent bites using repellents and wearing long sleeves and pants and doing a tick check when you come indoors, a really thorough check all over your body and your family members' bodies to see if you have picked up one of those ticks.
Yeah, one of those ticks. I'm still struck by the idea that they're the size of a poppy seed. That gets really small and hard to spot. Are those a problem later in the year just as they grow up, or do we see different ticks really thrive later in the summer?
Yeah, so what happens is ticks can typically go through a few different life stages is what they're called. So these juvenile ticks or the nymphal ticks that are really active right now, if they are successful at taking a meal, so this is a bite from a person or another animal and taking some blood from that individual, if they're successful at getting that blood meal, they will change into an adult phase tick. And those ticks as well can spread disease. They're even more likely to be infected with a bacteria or a virus that can make people sick because they've had just an extra opportunity to become infected by taking that extra blood meal. But all of these diseases that we're talking about in terms of spreading to humans and causing illness in Wisconsin are spread by the deer tick. So it's just one type of tick, but they can change from sort of that juvenile young tick into adult ticks later on in the summer.
And you mentioned wearing long sleeve clothing and using repellent. How can we safely prevent ticks and mosquitoes from hanging around our homes in the first place?
Yeah, so if you live somewhere where you see ticks or mosquitoes around your own property, some of the best things to do, especially we'll start with mosquitoes, are to go ahead and dump out any standing water. So this would be anything that's collecting water in and around your property. And it can be as small as just a few tablespoons of water can provide a really suitable breeding habitat for mosquitoes to lay their eggs and develop into adult mosquitoes. So you want to try and dump out any standing water that's collected in pots or, you know, tires or, you know, swimming pools, boats, buckets, wheelbarrows, anything that you can tip over and dump out every few days would be a good way to keep those mosquitoes from breeding. You can also mow frequently. Tall grass provides really great protection for mosquitoes to hide in the shade or when it's windy. So they tend to seek out that type of tall grass area. And then for, you know, on the tick side, you can certainly try and do some mowing as well. Ticks love any space that will provide them with some moisture. So they get really dried out when they're out in the sun. They tend to love leaf litter and tall vegetation as well. So if you can try and remove any additional vegetation and mow frequently around your property, or at least where people will be spending a lot of time, that will help prevent ticks. You can also put sort of a barrier like rocks or mulch or bark, something that's going to be the sort of dry space that can border an area where people might be spending time to prevent ticks from crawling into your yard. Hmm. And then also just using a prevention method on your pets is important as well, because they can bring ticks into your home.
All right, Rebecca, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rebecca Osborne is a vector-borne disease epidemiologist at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and we've been talking about tick and mosquito season. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a veteran whose world opened up after joining the military.
Memorial Day is Monday, and today we're going to reflect on the life of one fallen soldier. Meg Jones tells us about the Milwaukee-born captain of the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor.
Franklin Van Valkenburg spent his entire adult life training for war. And when that day came, Van Valkenburg would be among the first to die. He grew up in Milwaukee, son of a prominent lawyer, and when he left for the U.S. Naval Academy in 1905, Van Valkenburg never really came home again. He moved up through the ranks, serving on many vessels ranging from battleships to submarine tenders. In February 1941, Van Valkenburg was assigned to what would turn out to be his last posting, the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. It was Van Valkenburg's cruel fate to spend decades training for combat and die just 11 minutes into his first battle. It's true that America was caught by surprise when the Japanese attacked, but it's also true that the U.S. military was wary of Japanese aggression in the Pacific. That's why Navy commanders moved the Arizona and the rest of its fleet from the West Coast to Pearl Harbor. Like the other ship captains stationed at Pearl, Van Valkenburg repeatedly trained his sailors and Marines for battle. In a letter to his aunt 1 month before the Japanese attack, he wrote about the long hours he spent on the Arizona's bridge putting his men through their paces. "We never go to sea," he wrote, "without being completely ready to move on to Singapore if need be. Our eyes are constantly trained westward, and we keep the guns ready for instant use against aircraft or submarines whenever we are at sea. We have no intention of being caught napping." That's just what happened, though. A Japanese attack not at sea, but while most of America's Navy was in port. The USS Arizona's band was on deck preparing to play the national anthem for the morning flag raising when the first torpedo bombers with rising sun emblems began to drop out of the sky. They swarmed like hornets over Battleship Row, dropping torpedoes that streaked through the water, blowing holes in ships where sailors were sleeping, eating breakfast, and getting ready for shore leave.
"We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air."
When the Arizona's air raid alarm sounded at 7:55 a.m., Van Valkenburg was seen sprinting to the one place a ship's captain needed to be, the bridge. As he emerged from the conning tower, Van Valkenburg was hit by shrapnel that tore into his abdomen. He must have been in intense pain, but he refused to be carried to safety. Instead, he stayed at his post, directing the defense of his ship. Torpedoes rocked the Arizona, but the death blow came from a bomb that penetrated the deck and ignited the ship's forward ammunition compartment. Witnesses said it looked as if the Arizona leaped out of the water. A grainy color film shows a bolt of flame and black smoke blowing sky high as the ship exploded. It would become the iconic image of America's first minutes of World War II. It was 8:06 a.m. Van Valkenburg's body was never found. Only his Naval Academy class ring and two uniform buttons were recovered. He was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor, and to this day, he's officially listed as missing in action. His name is on the large white wall at the USS Arizona Memorial, along with the 1,176 men under his command who died at Pearl Harbor. Perhaps most fitting for a man who spent his entire life in service, his name is not at the top of the list of Arizona casualties. It's actually toward the bottom because the list is alphabetical. I think Franklin Van Valkenburg would have wanted it that way.
Meg Jones is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and author of the book World War II Milwaukee. She brought us the story of Captain Franklin Van Valkenburg. He was one of 56 Wisconsinites to die at the attack at Pearl Harbor. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
That remembrance was written by longtime Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Meg Jones. Meg died from cancer in December and spent much of her career covering Wisconsin veterans and service members. Next, learn how our changing climate is affecting pollen season and how that relates to COVID-19. That's just ahead here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Our next guest says pollen can make COVID-19 worse, and we're exposed to more of it because of changes to the planet. Louis Ziska is a plant physiologist. He teaches at Columbia University and was formerly with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service. He's published more than 100 research papers about our changing climate. He wrote a piece for The Conversation called Pollen Can Raise Your Risk of COVID-19, and the season is getting longer thanks to climate change. We talked earlier this spring. So how does pollen actually create a health risk related to viruses generally?
When you take pollen into your airways, it can sometimes affect your immune system in a way that affects the antiviral interferons, the response that your body makes to different viruses. And by inhaling the pollen, whether you're sensitive to pollen or not, that in turn can increase your susceptibility to respiratory viruses. And in this case, from the data we looked at, specifically the coronavirus.
That's interesting because I think of the effects of pollen being those allergic reactions. You're saying it doesn't really matter if your body reacts to it or not. It can still have an effect that makes you more susceptible to other respiratory viruses.
That's what we think. Often one of the things that can happen is that when you're exposed to pollen, it can also prime your immune system so that you're more resistant. And this was sort of an unexpected finding on our part. We're not sure why that is, and obviously we need to do a lot more investigation in that context. But we did do a deep dive into this. We looked at 130 pollen stations, 31 countries over 5 continents, and about 44% of the infection rate variability could be explained by the tree pollen season.
Help us understand what that means. How can you make that connection?
When you looked at what was happening in the spring of last year, there were some countries that we were calling lockdown. They were taking anybody and putting them on isolation so that they couldn't be outside. And by comparing different populations, those that were inside and not exposed to pollen, others that were, we were able to see or sort of quantify what the role of pollen was in terms of coronavirus susceptibility.
Ah, so when people were inside, you saw a lower infection rate than the areas where people were not stuck in their homes.
Well, yes, it's a little more complex than that, as it also relates to pollen loads, that is the amount of pollen that was in the air. And what we found was that an increase of pollen by about 100 pollen grains per cubic meter resulted in about a 4% on average increase of infection rates. And just to give that some context, 100 pollen grains per cubic meter is on the low end. You can get up to 500, 600, sometimes over 2,000 pollen grains per cubic meter, especially during the spring when trees are in bud and all of the pollen is to the point where you can actually see it blowing across your car.
It seems reasonable then, with this information, that people would want to avoid pollen, especially now. Short term, what can we do to limit our exposure?
Well, obviously, if there's a high pollen day and you're sensitive, you're probably not going to be going out and breathing heavily anyway. But what this really points to is the need to keep on wearing masks, particularly during the pollen season. Pollen is much larger than viruses, and so almost any mask will work and keep you from inhaling pollen. But it just reinforces, at least in the short term, the need to keep on wearing masks for a little bit longer.
Louis Ziska has published dozens of research articles about our changing climate and how it affects food and agriculture, plants, and public health. We're talking about how pollen can increase the seriousness of COVID-19 and how we're dealing with more pollen because of changes to the planet. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Louis, what are the ways the changing climate affects pollen season?
Well, they're sort of threefold. We're seeing earlier pollen seasons, where the springs are happening earlier, the falls are being delayed. That is, the first frost in the fall is being pushed back. So the time that you're exposed to pollen is getting longer. In addition to that, there is more pollen being produced. Carbon dioxide is a plant fertilizer, but it doesn't just affect the plants we'd like to have. It can also affect a number of plants that have a detrimental effect on public health because of the warmer temperature, because of the additional carbon dioxide. You're seeing plants growing faster, and they are, in fact, producing more pollen. We can measure it directly. The third thing is a little more esoteric in that when you look at the epstein, the surface of the pollen grain, the proteins that are on that surface are what elicit your response, your histamine response. What we're seeing, at least in some cases, and this has been done in a couple of labs, one in Korea and my own, showing that with rising carbon dioxide and potentially with changing temperatures, those protein numbers are going up. In other words, some of the proteins that elicit that allergenic response are increasing as a function of climate change. So overall, you have three effects, a longer season, more pollen, and a potential change in the allergenicity of the pollen that might cause you to be more susceptible to it.
And how do we measure pollen and know that our environments are producing more of it?
The reason why trees and things like ragweed release so much pollen is because it is, in fact, a very inefficient way of transferring the male pollen to the female flower. And so in order to overcome that inefficiency, you have to produce billions of grains. On the plus side, from the plant perspective, those are very cheap to make. Whereas if you have to do a flower, it's expensive in terms of how long it takes you to make the flower. And then you have to rely on a vector, a pollinator of some kind, to be able to transfer that pollen. So it's just simply a strategy that plants have evolved over time. Right now, we're measuring pollen through a series of pollen networks that are associated with the National Allergy Bureau. And it's basically still done by hand. You have to collect the pollen. You have to put it under a microscope. You have to look at it. You have to be an expert in knowing which pollen belongs to what species. All those folks that do this work are unsung heroes in my book, and they really do a fantastic job. You know, because it is a human requirement to be an expert in this field, there aren't enough pollen counters per se. And that's something that I'm hoping that in the next few years, we get a little more expertise in that area, more people that are familiar with it, and more stations going around the United States and the globe. But it takes a lot of training to become a pollen counter.
I know this is a really big question. How do you see our changing climate relating to public health?
In a number of different ways. And it is a big question, and there are a lot of different facets to it. Let me give you a very simple one. At some point, you've probably suffered from food poisoning. Something like 500,000 people every year suffer from it. When you have these bacteria that cause food poisoning, everything from E. coli to Clostridium, they respond to warmer temperatures. And as temperatures get warm, they're going to be selected for. That is a risk, a issue that we're concerned about in terms of public health. And from a plant perspective, as I am a plant person, we're concerned about things like poison ivy and how a changing climate might affect the ability of poison ivy to induce a rash. How does it affect plant-based medicines? How does it affect pesticide use? All of these things are part and parcel of the sort of links to public health that we're concerned about.
What do we do about that?
Well, there are a number of things that we can try and do. Obviously, we can both manage our interaction with some of the plants that may be affected by this. From the larger picture, of course, the idea is to try and mitigate climate change by controlling the amount of greenhouse gases that we put out, but also in terms of adapting. Some of the adaptations may be positive. If I'm a farmer and I have a longer growing season, well, maybe I want to grow something else. Maybe I can put in a double crop. Maybe I can do a different management strategy that will take advantage of the warmer weather. At the same time, if I have new pests, new diseases, I should put out some sentinel plots to make sure that, you know, some new biological threat isn't moving into the system. I have to be more aware that the pests and diseases that I'm facing may not be what my father or grandfather faced. So it's a fairly complex response. It's not a one-size-fits-all. But there are a number of things that I think that we can do as a society moving forward to both adapt and to mitigate.
Do you have hope that we will change the trajectory of climate change?
I think there was a quote from Winston Churchill that you can count on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted all the other possibilities. And sometimes I think that's where we are.
Lewis, thank you for your time.
You're more than welcome.
That was plant physiologist Lewis Ziska. We talked this spring about how our changing climate means pollen season lasts longer and includes more pollen. That's especially concerning this year because pollen can make COVID-19 worse. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 7:30, hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's been at the forefront of the fight against infectious diseases for 40 years, and COVID-19 made him a household name. Join us for that conversation tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news, and then Senate Republicans used their first successful filibuster last week. We've got the week in Washington ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.